Chapter 50. A Day. It will be remembered that the new, or rather old, acquaintances of the Count of Monte Cristo, residing in the Rue Meslay, were no other than Maximilien, Julie, and Emmanuel. The very anticipations of delight to be enjoyed in his forthcoming visits, the bright, pure gleam of heavenly happiness it diffused over the almost deadly warfare in which he had voluntarily engaged, illumined his whole countenance with a look of ineffable joy and calmness, as, immediately after the departure of Villefort, his thoughts flew back to the cheering prospect before him of tasting, at least, a brief respite from the fierce and stormy passions of his mind. It was the hour of noon, and Monte Cristo had set apart 1 hour to be passed in the apartments of Haydée, as though his so long-crushed spirit could not all at once admit the feeling of pure and unmixed joy, but required a gradual succession of calm and gentle emotions to prepare his mind to receive full and perfect happiness, in the same manner as ordinary natures demand to be inured by degrees to the reception of strong or violent sensations. The young Greek, as we have already stated, occupied apartments wholly unconnected with those of the Count. The rooms had been fitted up in strict accordance with the Eastern style, that is to say, the floors were covered with the richest carpets Turkey could produce, the walls hung with brocaded silk of the most magnificent designs and texture, while around each chamber luxurious divans were placed with piles of soft and yielding cushions that needed only to be arranged at the pleasure or convenience of such as sought repose. Haydée's female establishment consisted of 3 French attendants, and a 4th who was, like herself, a native of the climes of Greece. The 3 first remained constantly in a small waiting-room, ready to obey the first sound of a small golden bell, or to receive the orders of the Romaic slave, who just knew sufficient French to be enabled to transmit her mistress's orders to the 3 other waiting-women, who had received most peremptory instructions from Monte Cristo to treat Haydée with all the respect and deference they would observe to a queen. The fair Greek herself generally passed her time in the apartment, forming the extremity of the suite of rooms assigned to her. It was a species of boudoir, circular, and lighted only from the top, which consisted of pale pink glass. Haydée was reclining upon soft, downy cushions, covered with blue satin spotted with silver. Her head, supported by one of her exquisitely moulded arms, rested on the divan immediately behind her, while the other was employed in adjusting to her lips the coral tube of a rich narghile, whose flexible pipe, placed amid the coolest and most fragrant essences, permitted not the perfumed vapour to ascend until fully impregnated with the rich odours of the most delicious flowers. Her attitude, though perfectly natural for an Eastern female, would have been deemed too full of coquettish straining after effect in a European. Her dress, which was that of the women of Epirus, consisted of a pair of white satin trousers embroidered with pink roses, displaying feet so exquisitely formed and so delicately fair that they might well have been taken for Parian marble, had not the eye been undeceived by their constantly shifting in and out of the fairy-like slippers in which they were encased. These tiny coverings were beautifully ornamented with gold and pearls, and turned up at the point. A blue and white striped vest with long open sleeves trimmed with silver loops and buttons of pearls. She also wore a species of bodice which, closing only from the centre to the waist, exhibited the whole of the ivory throat and upper part of the bosom. 3 magnificent diamond clasps fastened it where requisite. The junction of the bodice and drawers was entirely concealed by one of those many-coloured scarfs, whose brilliant hues and rich silken fringe have rendered them so precious in the eyes of Parisian belles. A small cap of gold, embroidered with pearls, was placed with tasteful elegance on one side of the fair Greek's head, while on the other a natural rose of that dark crimson, almost inclining to purple, mingled its glowing colours with the luxuriant masses of her hair, which, for jetty lustre, outrivalled the raven's wing. The extreme beauty of the countenance, that shone forth in loveliness that mocked the vain attempts of dress to augment it, was peculiarly and purely Grecian. There were the large, dark, melting eyes, the finely formed nose, the coral lips and pearly teeth that belonged to her race and country. And to complete the whole, Haydée was in the very springtide and fullness of youthful charms. She had not yet numbered more than 18 summers. Upon Monte Cristo entering the apartments of the fair girl, he summoned her Greek attendant and bade her inquire whether it would be agreeable to her mistress to receive his visit. Haydée's only reply was to direct her servant, by a sign, to withdraw the tapestried curtain that hung before the door of her boudoir, the framework of the opening thus made serving as a sort of border to the graceful tableau presented by the picturesque attitude and appearance of Haydée. As Monte Cristo approached, she leaned upon the elbow of the arm that held the narghile, and extending to him her other hand, said, with a smile of captivating sweetness, in the sonorous language spoken by the females of Athens and Sparta, "Why demand permission ere you enter? Are you no longer my master, or have I ceased to be your slave?" Monte Cristo returned his smile. "Haydée," said he, "you well know."
"Why do you address me so coldly, so distantly?" asked the fair Greek. "Have I by any means displeased you? Oh, if so, punish me as you will, but do not speak to me in tones and manner so formal and constrained."
"Listen to me, Haydée," replied the Count. "I was about to remind you of a circumstance you are perfectly acquainted with, namely that we are now in France, and that you are consequently free."
"Free?" repeated the fair girl. "Of what use would freedom be to me?"
"It would enable you to quit me."
"Quit you? Wherefore should I do so?"
"That is not for me to say. But we are now about to mix in society, to visit and be visited."
"I desire to see no one but yourself."
"Nay, but hear me, Haydée. You cannot remain in seclusion in the midst of this gay capital, and should you see one whom you could prefer, think not I would be so selfish or unjust as to—"
"No, no," answered Haydée, with energetic warmth. "That can never be. No man could appear charming in my eyes but yourself. None save yourself and my father have ever possessed my affection, nor will it be bestowed upon any other."
"My poor child," replied Monte Cristo, "that is merely because your father and myself are the only men with whom you have ever conversed."
"And what care I for all others in the world? My father called me his joy. You style me your love, and both of you bestowed on me the endearing appellation of your child."
"Do you remember your father, Haydée?"
The young Greek smiled. "He is here and here," said she, touching her eyes and her heart.
"And where am I?" inquired Monte Cristo, laughingly.
"You?" cried she, with tones of thrilling tenderness. "You are everywhere."
Monte Cristo took the delicate hand of the young girl in his, and was about to raise it to his lips, when the simple child of nature hastily withdrew it, and presented her fair cheek instead. "You now understand, Haydée," said the Count, "that from this moment you are absolutely free, that here you exercise unlimited sway, and are at liberty to lay aside or continue the costume of your country as it may suit your inclination. Within this mansion you are absolute mistress of your actions, and may go abroad or remain in your apartments, as may seem most agreeable to you. A carriage waits your orders, and Ali and Myrta will accompany you whithersoever you desire to go. There is but one favour I would entreat of you."
"Oh, speak!"
"Preserve most carefully the secret of your birth. Make no allusion to the past, nor upon any occasion be induced to pronounce the names of your illustrious father or ill-fated mother."
"I have already told my lord it is not my intention to hold converse with anyone save himself."
"It is possible, Haydée, that so perfect a seclusion, though comfortable with the habits and customs of the East, may not be practicable in Paris. Endeavour, then, to accustom yourself to our manner of living in these northern climes, as you did to those of Rome, Florence, Milan, and Madrid. It may be useful to you one of these days, whether you remain here or return to the East." The fair girl raised her tearful eyes towards Monte Cristo, as she said with touching earnestness,
"My lord would mean whether we return to the East or continue here, would he not?"
"My child," returned Monte Cristo, "you know full well that whenever we part, it will be by no fault or wish of mine. The tree forsakes not the blossom that embellishes it. It is the flower that falls from the tree on which it grew."
"My lord," replied Haydée, "never will I quit you. For sure I am I could not exist if banished your presence. Alas, what would life be worth then?"
"My poor girl, you forget that 10 years will effect an essentially different change in both of us. To you that space of time will bring but the perfection of womanly graces, while it will wrinkle my brows and change my hair to grey. My father had numbered 60 years, and the snows of age were on his head, but I admired and loved him far better than all the gay, handsome youths I saw about his court. Then tell me, Ade, do you believe you shall be able to accustom yourself to our present mode of life?
Shall I see you?
Every day.
Then what does my lord apprehend for me?
I fear you're growing weary.
Nay, my lord, that cannot be. In the morning I shall rejoice in the prospect of your coming, and in the evening dwell with delight on the happiness I have enjoyed in your presence. Oh, believe me that when three great passions such as sorrow, love, and gratitude fill the heart, ennui can find no place.
You are a worthy daughter of Epirus, Ade, and your charming and poetical ideas prove well your descent from that race of goddesses who claim your country as their birthplace. Depend on my care to see that your youth is not blighted, or suffered to pass away in ungenial solitude. And of this be well assured, that if you love me as a father, I, in my turn, feel for you all the affection of the fondest parent.
Let not my lord be deceived. The love I bear you resembles in no degree my feelings towards my father. I survived his death, but were any evil to befall you, the moment in which I learned the fatal tidings would be the last of my life.
The Count, with a look of indescribable tenderness, extended his hand to the animated speaker, who carried it reverentially and affectionately to her lips. The carriage was prepared according to orders, and stepping lightly into it, the Count drove off at his usual rapid pace.